Okay. Therefore. That is, because of what... I take it to mean two things. Therefore, because of what has just been said in chapter 11, all the faithful witnesses, and also because of what has been said in the whole book up to now, because really that was the strength by which all those faithful witnesses were able to endure and were able to succeed in their faith. There have been four prominent warnings up to this point. In chapter 2, there was a warning against drifting away. In chapters 3 and 4, there was a warning to be faithful and diligent. In chapters 5 and 6, there was a warning against being lazy and becoming unskilled with the Word. And in chapter 10, there was a warning against willful sin and a reminder that it's fearful to fall into the hands of the living God. In chapter 12, we're going to see a fifth prominent warning in the book, and that's a warning against defilement, which we'll come to later on. So because of those warnings, because of the hope that we have in Christ, that is that He is better, because of the confidence that we have in God, because He is faithful, and because of the testimony of these faithful lives, He says, therefore. All those things come together. Therefore. Therefore what? Therefore let us also. And He says, He talks about this person who has, you know, a weight and has sin clinging to him. And you get this image of someone maybe who's, you know, slogging through the mud, and every step is just sucking up out of the mud. And you think, you look at the guy and you say, he's not going to make it. He can't get there. He needs to get out of the mud and get cleaned off. He needs to get rid of all that stuff. When you think about someone, or what are some of the other characterizations we have of sin? What are some other words that are used when we think about sin weighing us down, you know, from the Bible? We have words like entangled. What else? Ensnared, enslaved, ensnared, trapped. Okay, all those give you a picture of what sin does to you, and you have to somehow get rid of it. When someone competes in a race, like a swimmer, what does a swimmer do when he competes in a race? He's got to shave it all off, right? These guys who are really fast there, that's really weird, but they do, you know? They're getting rid of all the entanglements. Those cyclists, you know, they wear the funny helmet. It looks pretty silly, but they're streamlined. They're getting rid of all the wind block. Runners, they wear the lightest shoes possible. Do you know you can buy a pair of shoes for like, you know, over $100 that only weighs maybe 4 ounces and they're good for one race? But they do that just because they want the lightest thing possible. So they are aware of what is truly important when they're running a race, and they're getting rid of everything that's not important to them. They're willing to jettison everything else. Yeah, that's true. Get rid of all that stuff. Because you're not going to be successful carrying all that stuff. So we need to be aware, in the same way, that's an analogy for us, we need to be aware of what is real in life, what is truly important, and we need to be willing to forego all the things that are not. So let us also have that character about us. And look to Jesus, who is the founder or author, some versions say. And there's a couple of senses, I think, that He's the founder. One is that He planned it even before time. Remember in Ephesians 4, before the creation of the world, He was part of the plan that would bring about our salvation. So in that sense, He's a founder. Also, He's a founder in the sense that He initiated it. He was the firstborn, you know, in Romans 8. He was the firstborn among many. So He's the founder. He's the perfecter or finisher. And that is, He made what we have faith in, what I was trying to say, He made what we have faith in real. He's the one who made it real. Remember in the beginning of Hebrews 11, talking about, you know, faith is, you know, the assurance of things not seen. But what Jesus did is He made that stuff real. So He's the perfecter and finisher of it. Also, He makes sure that our hope is possible. Right? Because of Him, the hope that we have, we really do have hope. That the things that we hope for are really possible because of Jesus. So He's the perfecter of it. Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame, and considered the future joy of what he would succeed, the salvation that he would bring to all men. He considered that worth the pain and the shame of suffering. When you read back in Mark chapter 14 especially, I think, and the other Gospels as well, you read about this picture of Jesus in the garden, and it's not a happy time. There's great sorrow. There's weeping and agony and fear, trepidation. That's what you see he's going through right there. But then when you look in Hebrews 12, you see there was something else going on too. Because he had a vision of what was to come. And he saw the great joy that was to come, not only to him for having accomplished what God wanted him to, but also to all his people. And by looking forward to that, he was able to endure the agony that he was going through at the time. So we can look like Jesus did. When we look at Jesus, we can see him who endured. And we can have that same spirit in us to keep looking for the joy that is ahead of us. Okay, where is Jesus now? Seated at the right hand of God. That's where we look to him. We see that Jesus... Well, I want to read a few things here. First of all, this recalls to us really all the way back to chapter 1 and verse 3, where it says that Jesus, you know, having overcome, is now seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty on high. So all through the book of Hebrews, we've been told now that Jesus is better. His covenant is better. We have hope. We have confidence. We have a testimony of witnesses. We have a Savior seated on a throne who is victorious. When we look to that, that can give us, you know, that extra little thing we need to not just imagine that there's something better waiting for us, but we can see him who has achieved, who has become victorious, and keep our eyes on that. Okay, so having that in mind, we need to consider him. So let's look in, I want to read verses 3 and 4 now. Consider him who endured from sinners and such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. So we want to follow the... This is following a pattern that we've seen in the rest of the book, that Jesus is better, right? Jesus is better than Moses. His covenant is better than the old covenant. He's better than angels. So now we've had all these witnesses laid out before us. Now we have kind of the same thing. Jesus is the better witness. So we're going to consider him. We're going to look to him. And when we consider, I think what that means is kind of an ongoing consideration. We're going to constantly be reminding ourselves, and we're going to be remembering what Jesus did, remembering who we are, where we've come from, and reflecting on all these blessings that he's done for us. So we're going to consider him. And the reason we're going to consider him is, somebody look in verse 3 there. I'm going to get some interaction here. I've been talking a lot. So look in verse 3, and I'm going to ask you, why it is that we consider him. Is so that what? So that we're not discouraged, so that we don't grow weary. Right? There's a couple of things in there. We don't want to, if we get tired, we'll stop. We'll run out of energy. We won't continue on. If we lose our commitment, then we just lose the drive to keep going. So that's the reason to consider him and constantly be reflecting, is so that we don't get tired, so that we don't lose our commitment. So here's something that sometimes has been helpful to me. When you're tempted, say this to yourself. Self, if Jesus was willing to do that, you know, to give up so much for me, surely I can deny myself. Surely I can forego this temptation. I mean, he gave up his life. If he could die for me, surely I can give up this temptation, this little thing that is affecting me. Make that comparison in your mind. That's considering him. That's reflecting. That's looking to him who has succeeded. So, he says, you haven't died yet because of your conviction, you know, because of your commitment. But what's the implication there? Jesus did. He did, right? You haven't yet. You might someday, but he did. Look to him. So we too can endure if we realize, first of all, that we're never going to be free of some amount of suffering in this life. I mean, we shouldn't even be trying, really, to be free from suffering. As a means of finding joy and happiness, if you can't have joy and happiness with the suffering, you're never going to have joy and happiness. There's always going to be some suffering, some trials that we endure here on earth. So be ready for that. Be prepared. Get used to it. And seek joy and happiness another way. Remember, also, we can endure too if we remember the joy that's set before us, the crown of righteousness that awaits us, as Paul talked about in 2 Timothy. And keep our eyes on Jesus, who is already there. He is there where we want to go. So look to that. Okay. I'm moving fast because I have never actually gotten through a whole class that I wanted to. So that's one of my goals today. All right. Next section, the chastening of God. We might slow down a little bit here because there's some interesting things. So we're actually entering a section over verses 5 through, 24, I guess, where it's kind of jam-packed with a lot of quotations and references back to the Old Testament. And, you know, if you don't know they're there, you won't notice them. But it's really just one after another strung together. It's pretty impressive. So we're going to, first of all, look at the proper view of discipline. And this is in verses 5 and 6. So let's read verses 5 and 6. "And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord. Do not be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives." Okay, so the first part is actually a quotation from Proverbs 3, and it's the first part of Proverbs 3, which is really a part of is a section that is talking about trusting in God. And there's a lot of couplets in Proverbs 3 that are, you know, kind of pairs of things. If you do this, God will do this. If you trust in God this way, he'll bless you this way. Trust in him this other way, he'll bless you this other way. You know, a lot of couplets like that. So the message here is that in this particular couplet is that the discipline that is from God is actually a blessing from him. If you submit yourself to him, he'll bless you in these ways. And in this particular one, it says, don't regard it lightly. Don't be weary, because the Lord disciplines those he loves. The discipline from God is a blessing from him. So we might need to change the way we think about discipline. Sometimes we think about it as we don't want it. We don't like that. We don't like someone telling us we're wrong. And especially in, you know, a spiritual sense, because that's my character. I don't want to hear that. But we may need to change our way of thinking about discipline. So I want to read now verses 7 through 11, because that's really the whole section here on chastening from God. Verses 7 through 11. "It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." Okay, so there is a pattern of discipline that's set out for us here. Now, that first sentence in verse 7, in my opinion, is in the standard versions, American Standard, Revised Standard, English Standard, New American Standard, I think it's translated kind of poorly. It actually reads better, I think, because it's awkward, right? It says, "It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons." What does that mean? I don't get that. But like the Textus Receptus and the King James and the New King James and some of the less literal versions, like New Century Version and NIV, those have it, I think, in a way that seems to present the better wording, and it fits well in the context. Some of those versions will read something like this: "If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons." I like that better. That makes sense to me. Here's my paraphrase of that. If you are undergoing chastening, it is because God is being a father to you. That's how I read that. Does that make sense? Okay. So, when these people read this, it would have likely called their minds back to, because they're Hebrews mostly, right? They're all Jews. It would have probably recalled their minds to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Let's go back there. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Now what's going on here is after 40 years of wandering in the desert, here they are getting ready to enter the land of Canaan. They're right on the verge of it. So Moses gets them all together and he's having the talk with them. You know, you're getting ready to go in. We need to talk about some things here. And so look in verses, I want to read verses 2 through 5. Moses says, "And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you, and let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years." And here's the key verse. "Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you." All right, so they would have probably thought about this, right? When they heard the writer of Hebrews, you know, saying this, they may have, you know, had their minds go back to this. Now look down in Deuteronomy 8, verse 16. This is where we find out what God's motivation is for his discipline. In verse 16, he says, you know, "Who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to what? To do you good in the end." What's the purpose of God's discipline? What's his motivation? To do us good. He wants good things for us. And so sometimes we require a little discipline. Now look at in Deuteronomy 8, verses 19 and 20, because there's a strong warning at the end of all this. He says, "And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you today that you shall surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so shall you perish, because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God." A very strong warning there. Later in Hebrews, I think I must have skipped something there. But this is a warning that we're actually going to come to toward the end of Hebrews. There's a really strong parallel here between Moses talking to the Israelites, giving them these warnings, telling them to remember what God's discipline is for, and what's happening in Hebrews. Okay, later in Hebrews chapter 12, flip back over there now. Hebrews 12 and verse 22, he's going to say, "But you have come to a new kingdom." All right, so how did these people manage to get there? You know, on their own? Did they just kind of do really good and get there? God disciplined them to bring them to a new land. Okay, just like the people of Israel, where God disciplined them, and he was going to continue to discipline them, to bring them into a new land. God disciplined these people here in Hebrews, these Hebrews. He disciplined them to get to the new land, the kingdom, right? How does he bring us and all men to his kingdom today? By his discipline, right? He disciplines all of us to get us there. I actually did have it here. Note that chapter 12 ends with a very similar warning that we saw in Hebrews, and that is the warning is essentially obey or perish. It is a very strong warning. All right. So now, following that, we have a contrast with earthly fathers, and that's in verses 9 through 11 or so. And he notes that we respected our earthly fathers. Because, why do we respect them? Because their discipline, you know, led to various benefits in life, right? You do what your dad says and things are going to go better for you. And he's been there and he knows, you know, generally speaking. But what's the contrast? Submitting to God's discipline leads to what? What does it say? Someone look there.
Life.
You submit to your earthly father, things are going to go pretty well for you. You submit to God's discipline, it leads to life. What a contrast that is. How much better is that? Okay, we have this better thing going again. Our earthly fathers disciplined us as seemed best to them. Isn't that what we do, dads? You know, sometimes we wrestle with what's the right thing to do. What's the right amount of discipline? How hard do I come down? Do I just let them fail on their own? How do I do this? And is my motivation right? Am I just mad? Should I take a break? You know. We discipline as seems best to us. Not perfect for sure. But look at God. God disciplines us as is best. He knows. It is truly for our good. No doubt about it. His discipline is good for us. And what is the point of all of His discipline? What is it that God desires for us? There are two things there. You can see in verse 10 and also verse 11. See if you can find two things there that are the object of God's discipline for us. That we can share in His holiness. And what's the one in verse 11? The peaceful fruit of righteousness. Okay? He wants us to share in His holiness and to enjoy His righteousness. Those are the two objects of God's discipline for us. And later, we're going to pick up on why does He want us to be holy? Why does He want us to be righteous? That's coming along a little bit later in the book. Okay. Does God discipline us today? Yes? Yeah. God does discipline us today. It's how He gets us into the kingdom, right? He disciplines us to bring us to Him initially when someone's living in sin and doesn't know the Lord. He doesn't just kill people. You know, He lets them experience the consequences of sins, and He brings other people into their lives to reprove, rebuke, and exhort them. And this is God's way of bringing discipline to a person to initially get him or her into the kingdom. So that's one way He disciplines. He also disciplines us to get us back. You know, sometimes we leave. Sometimes we're there and then we fall away. And that's when God also applies discipline to us, to bring us back to Him. Again, what is the purpose of His discipline? To lead us to shared holiness and to righteousness. Now, here's the question. Why does He want us to be holy and righteous? It doesn't actually say it right here, but toward the end of the chapter it does. Look in verse 28. What is the result of holiness and righteousness on our part? We get to be where? We get to be in the kingdom with Him, right? So He disciplines us to make us holy and righteous. Why? So we can be with Him. That's what He wants. He loves us and wants us to be there with Him. That's the whole purpose of His discipline. All right, so here are some tough questions for us. Does God want us to know, does God expect us to know when He's chastening us? You might ask yourself, did He expect the people in the Bible to know when He was chastening them? These are questions for thoughts. I see some heads. I think that's a good statement. Yeah, it's a fair statement. Tony?
Well, I think that while we may not realize exactly what's happening, if you take a child and have an earthly father, they may not understand exactly what's happening, why it's happening at that point, but hopefully they come to understand.
Yeah, okay,
and
good.
Maybe that's the type of thing here. As we're older and get more mature, we should realize that, yeah, this is what's happening.
Right, right. That's a good way to say it.
If we didn't understand that we were being disciplined, it would be kind of hard to learn the lesson.
Excellent. Right. Russ?
I think a lot of times it's extremely obvious. I mean, I think it's not that, you know, is that a discipline or not?
Yeah.
I think when we're reading the scriptures and we're convicted by the things that are said, and we look at our lives and it doesn't compare, or you know, that things happen when the brethren are talking to us and we can see things happen in their lives. That, you know, a lot of times, you know, I know that there's sins of ignorance.
Sure.
That's not the majority of the problems that we have.
Right.
Discipline is a constant. If you're reading the scriptures, you're always fine-tuning yourself. And that is the discipline that's so obvious in our lives.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yes, sir.
Literally, every time you study the Bible, we read, we're getting contrast, we're getting
so you know when you haven't been matching up. So based on all the things that have been said, we should be able to understand, perceive the difference between when God's disciplining us and when we're just being persecuted, you know, for what we believe in, or time and chance even. You know, there's bad things that happen because we live in a fallen world. We should be able to discern that, and you know, part of it involves, like what Tony said, becoming more mature. What Bob was talking about, you know, growing in our knowledge of the Scriptures. And, you know, having a relationship with God where we understand what, you know, He's how He's communicating with us. So, yeah, excellent. We should know. We should be aware of that. Otherwise, yeah, like Tony said, how are you going to know to, you're supposed to be changing. You know, God's expectation is that His discipline brings about change. And if we just think, oh, I'm suffering because I'm so great, you know, you should know that you're not suffering because you're so great. That's God disciplining you. You need to change. Okay, so we may not know exactly how. We may not be able to put our finger exactly on it, but by faith and by all these things that you've said, we should know. We can know. Well, that wasn't as much of a can of worms as I thought it might be. Okay, guard each other. Diligently guard each other. Let's read verses 12 through 17. I love this. I don't know why. This just sounds great. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. That no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. All right, first item, lift your drooping hands. Does this infer that we should, you know, just pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps? And, you know, it's all about, if I just work hard enough and push hard enough, I'll just get myself back into the kingdom. Is that what's being implied here or commanded to us? Okay, everybody shake your head. No. No, it's not. This is actually a quote from Isaiah 35, verse 3. It says, lift up your drooping hands. And in the context of Isaiah 35, it's a context in which God is coming to save them. God's coming to rescue them. And the intent of this admonition is it is intended to energize them to be vigorous in defending their righteousness. But it's not, you know, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's by God's grace who's going to come in and rescue you and save you, but you need to get vigorous in defending your righteousness. So that's what he's telling them here. You know, get energized. Yes, sir.
When you look again, you had that word therefore.
Yep. Yeah,
so
good point.
Mm-hmm. And then we get down here to the last part of verse 13, but rather be healed.
Yeah.
Because that's how it is in verse 9.
Yeah, yeah. So he's talking about the lameness. Mm-hmm. Nice. So the next part is, just following on that, make straight paths. This is possibly a reference to Proverbs 4, verses 26, 27, where it says pretty much exactly the same thing. Get the clutter out of the way. You know, don't let there be things that are going to cause you to fall. Clean it out so you can make your course straight in the direction you know you need to go. You know whether there are some things that you need to get rid of. Right? You know that. In particular, based on God's discipline, clean it out. Set those things aside. Get yourself going the right direction. This next part about the lame being healed, lest it come out of joint. There's actually something very similar to this, a strong image in 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 21. Elijah's up on Mount Carmel. There's the prophets of Baal. You know, there's everyone who's standing around watching. And Elijah calls down to him and says, "How long are you going to be limping between God and Baal?" And you know, versions have it different ways: limping, or halting, or wavering, or faltering. You know, how you think about someone who's lame, and they do that. You know, they kind of, and that's kind of the image he's got going here. How long are you going to be, you know, between this and between that? You know, you're just wobbling back and forth. And that's the image he has here. And it's relevant because the Hebrew saints here were kind of wobbling between Christ and Judaism, right? That's one of the things they've been struggling with. So suddenly there's this image of, oh, the Israelites, they wobbled between God and Baal, and look what happened to them. And now here we are wobbling between Christ and Judaism. That's a very bad place to be in. So stop the wobbling. You know, don't be this lame thing. Straighten it up and, you know, choose righteousness. And in fact, he says next, strive for peace. This is likely a quotation of Psalms 34, verse 14. So you see how they're just all stacked on here? You know, Isaiah 35, Proverbs 4, 1 Kings 18, Psalm 34. Just like he took all these things and pulled the whole message together. Boom, boom, boom. Here it is. It's been all through the Bible, and now here it is, laid out. Strive for peace. Psalm 34, after David had shamed himself by acting like a madman. Remember, we just had a lesson a while back about that from Andy. David was speaking to those who, in Psalm 34, speaking to those who desired life and wanted to see good. I expect that was applicable to the Hebrews here. I'm sure they desired life and wanted to see good. And so he's telling them, strive for peace. That's the same thing David said. If you want life and to see good, strive for peace. And now, see to it. Some versions say, looking carefully, looking diligently. What is it that we're supposed to see to? There's a couple of things in there. See if you can find a couple of things that we're supposed to see to. Okay, that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. What else are we supposed to see to? Make sure that a root of bitterness does not spring up and cause trouble. Okay, this is not talking about someone who has a problem with bitterness, like over in James, you know. That's different. This is not that. This is, I believe, a reference to Deuteronomy 29. So if we can flip over to Deuteronomy 29. And verses 18 and 19. Beware lest there be among you a man or woman or clan or tribe whose heart is turning away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations. Beware lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit. One who, when he hears the words of the sworn covenant, blesses himself in his heart, saying, I shall be safe, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart. This will lead to the sweeping away of moist and dry alike. Okay, the root of bitterness he's talking about is someone who is turned away from God, not being subject to the Lord. They spring up in the midst of you. They decided they're not going to do what's right, and they cause trouble. And it's bitter. It's poisonous to the whole group. Talking about someone who ignores God's discipline. They're being disciplined. They ignore it. They're going to do what they want anyway. And they cause others to become defiled right along with them. That's the root of bitterness that we must avoid. The word here, see to it, or look diligently, or look carefully, is actually a word that you've probably heard before, the Greek word, episkopeo. It sounds a lot like another Greek word that, episkopos. What is episkopos? What do we usually translate that as? Bishop or elder, or actually literally overseer, right? Epi is above, skopos to see, episkopos. It's an overseer. This is like the work of an elder. But in this context, he's telling the people You need to be looking diligently, overseeing, taking some initiative. How do I write it here? Yeah, take responsibility for the outcome of somebody else's life. See to it that no one falls away and loses out on the grace of God. See to it that no root of bitterness springs up within you. These are hard words. This is hard to do. This is something we're not comfortable with. This involves, personal engagement, personal involvement in what we might consider sometimes private aspects of our lives, of each other's lives. Verse 16, we're supposed to see to it that, specifically, no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau. How are you going to know that about someone? This is looking carefully into somebody else's private life. This is a delicate thing, right? And he's warning against being sexually immoral, and he's warning against being spiritually immoral. That was really the core of what was going on with Esau, right? He was profane. He had no regard for what was holy. It was unimportant to him. So there's sexual immorality, spiritual immorality that's being talked about here. How comfortable are we with this command to see to it? I'm not comfortable with this. This is not an easy thing to do. Yes, sir. Yes, okay. You.
I think we have to be careful how far we can take that.
Yes.
Okay. I don't think what he's saying here is that we have to be a bunch of sleuths
to
each other's lives. But we, as brothers and sisters, can help to teach each other and build each other up, whether it's by example or whatever.
Right. Yes.
We build each other up and help each other grow these strong positions. And I think that's much what's talked about here. And as we are part of each other's life, maybe we'll become aware of them.
And that's, I think, the key right there. Because are there not times in our conversations with each other that sometimes we pick up on something and you wonder, huh? Yeah, I wonder if I should ask. Yeah. You should ask. If there's anything that's a little clue that someone might be in danger of losing out on the grace of God, yeah, you should ask about that. And, not prying and snooping and poking into people's lives, but when you get a sense, and we do get that, we get a sense of, hey, something's not quite right here. Have the courage to follow the command, to look into it diligently. Jesse, your hand? Right. Good point. Yeah. Yep. Yes, sir.
Well, I still look at these verses, but you're still in them. I still look at this as you're looking at yourself to make sure that you're being peace with yourself. And even looking careful lest anyone should fall. I mean, you are looking out for each other, but I think it's still the emphasis throughout the whole chapter 12 and 11, taking those examples of those that have gone on before, as they're in the cheering crowds, as you talked about, as they're crossing this race, Jesus is the ultimate pinnacle that does this great example. And then if you're coming, we need to apply that all. Yeah, we're looking out, but still, I think this whole chapter is primarily looking at ourselves, how we can be peaceful amongst and how we can do this. So there is an element that we're looking out for each other, but still, I still look at this as more of an inward look and showing each other by the examples that we have made just as a cloud of witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the reason I feel somewhat differently is mainly because he talks about, you know, we're supposed to see to it that no root of bitterness springs up among you. So it seems to be something that's more of a group thing. But I think everything, you know, that you're you know, talking about in terms of the individual is exactly right on. So when we have conversations with each other, when we do have the courage to bring up some of these things and work through it together and help someone out of the mud, you know, wash it off and start making better progress. Sometimes when we approach someone, there's not going to be a good response. If someone approached me, I would have a hard time making a good response. It's the way we are, you know. But if we respond, sorry Bob, I'll get to you in a second. If we respond to someone's care for us the right way, what will we have been spared from? Now look in verse 17. If we respond to someone trying to drag us out of the mud the right way, what will we have been spared from? Verse 17, it says about Esau, he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, no chance to repent. There will come a time when it's too late. There will come a time when it's too late both for an individual. There will come a time when it's too late for a group of Christians that has let a bitter root grow up within them. Sometimes you go over the edge and there's no return. If we will respond to the loving care of each other, then we can avoid that. That's the warning for us here, to avoid that. Bob, did you want to say something? Yeah, absolutely. Right, what's important, yeah. And what we're trying to avoid, you know, because it can be too late, what we're trying to avoid is, well, look in verse 29 there. For our God is a consuming fire. This is a real warning, right? This is serious. End of, you know, well, eternal, you know, God's a consuming fire. Okay. Yes. Talking to me. Great point. Great. Thank you. Okay. Zion better than Sinai, right? We've got this better thing going again here. Let's look at verses 18 to 24. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. Even if a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Okay. The first promise, verses 18 to 21, obviously a reference back to Exodus 19 and 20. There's a setting characterized by fear and awe. The Israelites had just come out of Egypt. They were a disorganized band of slaves. There at Mount Sinai, God gave them a law. They became a nation. The first of God's promises to Abraham was fulfilled. He made them into a great nation. Note that there's a spiritual sense of that promise too. Are we Christians today a great nation? Yeah, in the spiritual sense. We are a great nation. Exactly. Okay, the second promise. What was God's second promise to Abraham? I'll make you a great nation. I will give to you a great land. Right? Okay, so when was that fulfilled? When did they get the great land? When they marched across, you know, the Jordan and in and took it and took Canaan. They eventually took Jerusalem, which is built on Mount Zion, right? So that's the physical sense of Jerusalem and Mount Zion. Now in verse 22, we see the spiritual sense of the second promise fulfilled. He says, but you have come to Mount Zion. And we have a picture as you're reading through here. You get a picture that you're getting, you know, closer and closer, and there's more and more detail. And starts out by you see the mountain. And then you see the city on the mountain as you get closer. And then, oh, there's these innumerable angels all around it. And as you get closer, you see there's the church, the righteous, right? Made perfect. And then in the middle of it all, there's God with all the spirits all around him of the saints. And then, oh, right beside him, there's Jesus. And then you get a little bit closer and you realize that's Jesus, the Lamb, standing as though slain, like in Revelation 5, right? He's been sacrificed. So you get closer and closer until you see all these details. Note that at the end of chapter 11, verses 39 and 40, all these faithful witnesses, and all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. They did not then receive the promise. Okay, what promise was he talking about? I got a buzz here. Have we been made perfect, cleansed from all unrighteousness? Have we been made perfect? Yeah. We have been made perfect, cleansed from unrighteousness. Have they now been made perfect together with us, those faithful witnesses? Yep, sure have. Have they now received the promise? Yeah. All those spirits of, you know, righteous made perfect that we just saw, that, you know, they're there. All right. Have we also received this promise? Yeah. You have come. They have. We have, right? In Philippians 3:20, it says, our citizenship is going to be in heaven? No. Our citizenship is in heaven right now. You have come. You have the promise. They have it now too. Okay. So we can think of this promise as a spiritual land promise, right? It's like the second promise to Abraham. We have it within our grasp. We have come to Mount Zion. It's just not yet fully realized in the final sense. Okay. Still trying to buzz here. Third promise. What still remains before this is fully realized? What's God's third promise to Abraham? All nations will be blessed through him, right? A prophecy that Jesus Christ would come. Can we talk about it after? Okay. That's what I'm getting to. The third promise was a promise that Jesus would come to save us, right? To save all men. Now look in verse 27. When is this going to happen? He says, yet once more I will shake not only the earth but also the heavens. When does that happen? When Christ comes again. Okay, this is when Christ comes again. God fulfills his third promise in its final sense. Okay, but that has not happened yet. That has not happened yet, and therefore, he leaves us with a warning. And the warning is in 25 to 29. How much time do we actually have? Am I over? Okay. See that you did not refuse him who is speaking, for if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken, that is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Well, I didn't make it again, but it was close. I only had that much more to go. So, if anyone's interested, we can talk more afterwards.